At the bottom of the chart, you can see that we have the listing of the Hasmonean family, which is the term which is used to describe this family we know as the Maccabees, who led the revolt. We're not exactly sure of the origin of the name. It seems to be shrouded, as they say, it's a rather trite expression, in the mists of history, where that name came from, but it's presumed to have been, by most authorities, to have been some sort of a family name from some ancestor whose name was Hasmon. But this is the term that I probably will consistently use to describe them, though I may call them Hasmoneans or Hasmonean on different occasions. Both of them are common enough pronunciations, and I doubt if I'll use the purely Hebraic Hashmonim, so you don't have to worry about that one at least. It says here, Roman numeral 3, the rise of the Hasmoneans to political leadership of the nation. Judah led the successful revolt for religious freedom from 168 to 162 B.C. That's where, of course, if that was beyond the cleansing of the temple, of course, but where they had received a guarantee of their religious autonomy, that they would not have to suffer any longer from this forced Hellenization. However, he sought to expand this religious autonomy to political independence and died in 160 B.C. in the effort to do so. Jonathan, his brother, succeeded him as the rebel military leader, and in one of those compromises I referred to previously, he was appointed the high priest. Notice that, appointed the high priest by the Seleucid rulers in 152, and did succeed in expanding Judean territory somewhat. Simon succeeded Jonathan as the rebel leader. Jonathan was assassinated in, I forget the exact year now, I'm sorry, I don't remember. It was after 152, but he was assassinated. He was invited to a dinner party by the local Seleucid military governor, and it was just an attempt to lure him to his death, and he was assassinated at the banquet. So Simon succeeded Jonathan at that point. And I already noted that he secured a tax exemption from the Seleucids in 142 due to Roman support and inter-Seleucid rivalries, which meant that, as I said, Judea had no responsibility for paying any taxes to the Seleucids. And along with that, they were able to coin their own money. And so for all practical purposes, they were recognized as being an independent nation. He was also recognized by the Seleucids as both the high priest and the ethnarch, the civil ruler of Judea. And so we see a progression. Judah was simply a military leader. Jonathan inherited that office and, in addition, was appointed by the Seleucids as a high priest. Simon inherited both the position of being military leader and being high priest, and then, of course, was appointed by the Seleucids to be ethnarch, or political leader of Judea. And so we have a combination of roles. I wouldn't quite say comparable to the character Pooh-Bah in the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta in the Mikado, but we do have the individual who's at the top of this leadership pyramid wearing more than one hat. And this practice of the leader being not only the civil leader, but the chief religious leader and also the military commander-in-chief was to be a source of controversy for quite a period of time. Yes, Ms. Reagan. No, he was the ethnarch. Yeah, he was that individual. Fine. Now, when Simon secured this practical independence from the Seleucids and had his title of ethnarch confirmed by them, which is not that unusual. Say, well, why did they even give him the title if he was independent? This is not unusual. For example, by way of analogy, in European history, as the area of Brandenburg, Prussia, began to expand and become more powerful in the 18th century, the ruler originally was not the king of Prussia. He had he was the Duke of Prussia. But the Holy Roman Empire allowed him to call himself King in Prussia, which is a small step down from King of Prussia. That doesn't probably mean much to us, but apparently it was a big thing in those days. The difference in that little preposition meant a lot of difference. And then eventually he won the right from the empire to call himself king of Prussia. Although the empire did not have any effect on what he did in his own country, he was totally independent in his ability to rule his own country. He couldn't take a title without the approval of the Holy Roman Emperor. This is just the way things ran. And that's sort of the situation we have here, is that Simon just couldn't take any title he chose, even though he was running an independent country, and he was allowed by the Seleucid rulership to style himself, you know, in his letters to others, as ethnarch of Judea. So he had to form a government for Judea, and he had a number of choices. He could have set up a monarchy, for example. Now, that sounded inviting, partly because, obviously, that was the traditional form of government that independent Judea had had. And remember now, we're opening a new page in Judean history. This is the first time since 586 BC that Judea is a totally independent state. All the time in between, it has been ruled by others. And so there would have been a natural tendency to maybe want to go back to the system of government that Judea had last enjoyed under its last independent period, that being a monarchy. It could also have established an aristocratic form of government, or an aristocracy, because that was a fairly common form in this period. For example, they had the model of Rome. The Roman Republic was essentially an aristocratic creation. The Senate really ran the Roman Republic. Although there were other officials and other bodies in the Republican system, the Senate was the dominant body in the Roman Republican system, and it was made up of the wealthy aristocratic families who controlled membership in the Senate. And so essentially that's what it was. Or it could have followed what was very common in the area of the Near East. They could have established a democracy, where they would have had a representative assembly that made the laws for the state, and the people who were chosen for the representative assembly could have been elected by, you know, various power groups in Judea, or directly by the people, whichever way they chose. So these were the choices that faced Simon. But yet each of the choices represented something that they couldn't really go with. What would have been the difficulty for Simon? Remembering, he is, by appointment, the ethnarch of Judea. He is the high priest. He is the military commander-in-chief. What would have been a problem for him in setting up a monarchy with himself as king? Right. And that would fly right in the face of tradition, you know, that only somebody of the house of David could be a king. Well, he could still set up a monarchy and find somebody for the house of David to become the king, but then he wouldn't be in charge anymore. And human nature being what it is, that wasn't too appealing. And so he had some serious questions about that. He was not of Davidic lineage. Certainly monarchy can be a very efficient form of government. And certainly it puts a lot of power in the hands of the person who is the monarch, which was appealing, but he just didn't see his way clear to doing that. What about democracy? Why do you think he might have shrunk back from establishing a democratic system of government in Judea? No idea. Dan? Okay, that's one aspect. Why else might he not want to, having successfully won both religious and now political independence from the Seleucid Empire, not particularly wish to institute a democratic form of government? Why?
Because people would tend to do what the majority of people want to do as far as go back to competition.
Very good. Because the Hellenization had struck some pretty deep roots, you see. Remember, it was a minority led by this family that had staged the revolt and succeeded in it. The majority either couldn't care less or were actively interested in Hellenization and had wanted to pursue it. And so you're right. Putting hands, decision-making power into the hands of, quote, the majority would have been heading them right back to where they had not wanted to be, where they had escaped from. So rule of the majority, or I should say by the majority, or by majority will, might have led them back into Hellenization. Anything else that you might think of that might cause them just to quail at the very idea of having a democratic system? Now, Arthur touched upon the substantive reason, but there's also something just in the surface thing itself. Where did democracy develop as a system of government? Persia? Babylon? Egypt? Greece? It by itself was preeminently a Greek way of doing things, uniquely Greek way of doing things. And, you know, you've just fought a rebellion to free yourself of Greek influences, and then you set up a government which is uniquely a Greek form of government that sort of doesn't quite, follow through logically. So this is the substantive reason, but there's also the fact that it was a uniquely Greek form of government that made him sort of quail at the idea of establishing a democracy for Judea also, as well as what was mentioned before, that he would lose personal power if it was a democratic government. But what about an aristocracy that would seem to combine some of the strengths of monarchy and democracy, because you have sort of a representation and you avoid the concentration of power, and maybe that might not be so good. But why do you think he wasn't too anxious to set up a system which gave all the government power to the aristocrats, which would have been the large landowners and upper echelon people of the state? Ah, now we have a few more people willing to risk their necks. Kirby? Yeah. Exactly. They would have been in the forefront of Hellenization and therefore were tainted by it. Are you going to turn over the government and its policies to those very same people? I mean, what are they going to end up doing, you see? This is something you really have to worry about. So the aristocrats had led the way into Hellenization. So what should you do? It's not just being caught between a rock and a hard place. You're caught between the rock, a hard place, and the deep blue sea. So you've got to have some sort of government. So what do you think he ended up doing? Yes. Go ahead.
Well, he's already exarch. He's already high priest. What can he do there?
Okay, he could have done that, and to a degree that's what practically worked out, but in actual fact he actually combined elements of all three, created a blend of these possible systems. It was a monarchy in the sense that he was the supreme ruler, you might say, but just as Dan said, by virtue of being both head of the religious establishment as high priest and ethnarch, head of the political establishment, and commander-in-chief. He obviously had all the main levers of power, so he was a supreme ruler. But what he set up was something that was very much like a monarchy. You might call it a constitutional monarchy without a king. The net result was a constitutional monarchy without a king. A constitutional monarchy without a king. A king in the sense of somebody carrying that specific title. That's why I'm putting the word king in italics. If I had italics, I could write italics, I would. But I'll put it in quotes. I don't know how to write italics on the blackboard. But he was the supreme ruler. But what he set up was something that was called, and here I'd like to expose you to the Hebrew term, though I will not write it in Hebrew letters for your sakes. The Heber HaYehudim. It's not really that hard. the Hever HaYehudim, and translated into English, this would be called the Council of the Jews. Though in the literature we could call it by an Aramaic word, which is actually derived from a Greek word, a word which you've heard before, which is the Sanhedrin, or Sanhedrin, to give it its Aramaic pronunciation. I think you're familiar with the term Sanhedrin from its existence in the days of Jesus. Now, this particular body did represent, you might say, an element of democracy in the government because of its responsibilities. As I said, we have a constitutional monarchy. Now, what is true of all constitutional monarchies that makes them different from absolute monarchies? What is the essential difference? No matter what kind of constitutional monarchy you have, they all share one thing in common. Mrs. Reagan? That's not true in all of them, however. That would not be true in all of them. For instance, Britain has no written constitution. But there's something that is true of all constitutional monarchies, whether they have written constitutions, unwritten ones, or whatever. There's an essential ingredient that's true. Yes. Yeah. Right. He is subject to the law. He's limited by the law. And, of course, that's why in our Western traditions we magnify so greatly the Magna Carta, because beyond anything it had within it, it established the very important general principle that the king in England was not above the law. He was equally to be judged by it and had to conform to it. A fundamental principle that was established so early on in England, that is the root of all of our constitutional liberties and rights and privileges we take too often for granted. So there are limitations on this supreme ruler. Now, one of the limitations that you would expect to find in a state that is attempting to live by God's ways is that he cannot just rule any way he likes and make laws as he sees fit, but he has to be bound by the laws of the Torah. But that, in essence, represents the fundamental laws of the state. And if he makes any new laws, they have to be in conformity with God's laws. They can't be contradicting God's laws. They can't be violating God's laws. Now, this is one of the things the Hever HaYehudim had to do. This is one of their responsibilities. They had to check that all new laws were in conformity to the laws of God. I should say, really, all new laws and government policies. All new laws and government policies were in conformity to the laws of God, because that was their fundamental constitution. The second responsibility of this Hever HaYehudim, or Sanhedrin, was to suggest new laws. Notice they did not decide on their own what would become law, and the ethnarch was just powerless to prevent it. He had to simply endorse anything the Sanhedrin came up with. They suggested new laws for his consideration, and if he felt they were valid, he would institute them. But even if the ethnarch himself, Simon himself, decided on a new law or a new major government policy, the Sanhedrin had the responsibility of reviewing that new law, that new policy, and deciding whether it was in conformity to the Torah or not. And then, of course, that would determine whether it actually could function. Now, the makeup of this Hever HaYehudim was very interesting. You want a representative body here. I'll use the word Sanhedrin, or Sanhedrin, if that makes it easier on your ears. Basically, there were four groups who were in this body. If this is to be a truly representative body, who needs to be in it? What groups must be represented?
Jews.
Flavia? Okay, your priests have to be in there. Because, remember, part of their function is to dealing with the laws and policies and, you know, in the religious considerations. You have to have them in there. Who else has to be in there? Especially because you're looking at new laws and policy and measuring them against God's law and trying to make a decision as to whether they conform or don't. Who's able to do this? Richard? Now, the scribes in this period are no longer an exclusively priestly group. Now, in the Old Testament period, scribes were priests. So Ezra, being a ready scribe in the law, is no surprise that he was also a priest. God had assigned them the responsibility for keeping the oral and written law. That was their assignment. And I gave you earlier on in the semester some verses of scripture in Ezekiel and in Haggai Malachi, that showed that that was their God-given responsibility. The problem was is that to become a scribe, as I think you are now aware, was a very arduous task if you're going to be any good at it. It took a long time of extensive education before you could do that, and increasingly priests were less and less willing to do it. Because going through all that difficult training added not one whit to their livelihood and not one whit to their prestige. Their livelihood and prestige came from their functioning as a priest. Going through all that arduous study didn't add anything. And so many of them became increasingly disinclined to do it. And so in order to make sure there were enough scribes, they had to recruit lay people to become scribes. And so you're beginning now in this period, at the time of Simon, to have a group which is mixed, partly priestly in origin, partly laymen in origin, all being trained as scribes. Okay, who else would have to be in here if this is to be representative of the population as a whole? Alan? Right. I'll call them secular nobles, aristocrats. So what group is now unrepresented as yet? Sophie? Yes, or as I like to call them, the common herd. Because they usually are sheep, going wherever they're led by their leaders. Now, you can't. They didn't want to go to the direction of having popular elections for everybody who was basically part of the common herd to get together and elect who their representatives would be. Given the organizational structure of Israelite life, dating from all the way back from the time of the judges until this period, it hadn't changed essentially in that respect, except, of course, Israel has been diminished in terms of its tribal nature. Most of the tribes are gone. We only have a few tribes left. Who has for centuries functioned as sort of the leaders of the common people? What individuals? Edith? Exactly. And so we have elders, the tribal and city elders, who sit in this body. Now, in number, this group numbered 120 men. Now, I make mention of that for two reasons. One, because I think the number is indicative of something. It shows that in their desire for continuity, the leaders of the modern-day state of Israel, having formed a legislative assembly, a parliament, in order to demonstrate continuity with the past, since this period we're now entering, the Hasmonean period, was the last period of independence. The Jews had an independent state of their own until 1948 A.D., they made their parliament have 120 seats. I say that's why they deliberately chose that particular number. That's one reason why I refer to it. But another reason I'm referring to it is more immediate to our concerns. And that is a parliament, so to speak, or a consultative legislative assembly, as this was, of 120 men is not overly large. After all, our Congress manages to function with what? How many members? Interesting. It's amazing to me always how little Americans know about their own government. Usually Canadians and Britishers know more about their own and ours than Americans. Yes, Steve? 435 in the House of Representatives, so 535. We managed somehow, though it seems with decreasing efficiency, to have a legislature of 535 people. Obviously, that's not impossible, you know, with 120. But that's one thing, to have sort of a consultative assembly that has to weigh new laws and whether they should or shouldn't be adopted, or new policies. But what about day-to-day administration of a government? I'm not talking about a bureaucracy. I'm talking about top-level officials who directly advise and counsel and take and carry out the administrative decisions of the top leader. Can you do it with a body of 120 people? That's rather large, especially given the size of Judea. It would make a very cumbersome administrative council charged with day-to-day administration. And so simply out of necessity, rather than out of conscious design, another body emerged. Now, this other body we can call the administrative cabinet. If we want to use that term. In the same manner, the Constitution of the United States does not mention cabinet officers. Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of Defense, they are not mentioned at all in the Constitution. It was not anticipated they would be needed. But once the system started operating, the president realized that to carry out his responsibilities as chief executive, he could not do everything himself. He couldn't be Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of Defense. He just couldn't do all those things intimately himself. He needed assistance. And so he created these. And so this is an ad hoc thing in our system of government, just as it was here in ancient Judea at the time of Simon when he was setting up his government. As he felt the need to select out of these groups here in the Sanhedrin, individuals who could serve him as day-to-day administrators working under his authority. In the same way, Mr. Armstrong, of course, used to administer everything in the work for years, directly. But, of course, then had to delegate to individuals certain functions as they grew too large and would have become too time-consuming for him. He would not have been able to continue writing and continue doing the broadcasts if he had tried to do all these administrative tasks. And, of course, right now we have, of course, Mr. Tkach being assisted by several top-level administrators, each with their own clearly defined responsibilities. They serve sort of as a cabinet, you might say, to him. Now, in actual fact, this administrative cabinet acquired the same name as the Consultative Legislative Assembly, which I call the Cheva HaYehudim or the Sanhedrin. They both were called Sanhedrin. Now, because of that problem, if I, in the future, were to say the Sanhedrin decided to do this, or the Sanhedrin decided to do that, you wouldn't know if I was talking about the large consultative body of 120 people, or I was talking about the smaller administrative cabinet. And so what I'm going to do, not because it was done then, but in order to make your comprehension easier, is use the Greek form of this word Sanhedrin, the original Greek form, to describe the administrative cabinet. And that word is Synhedrion. Synhedrion. S-Y-N-H-E-D-R-I-O-N. And so now we can see the whole structure of the government. We have the supreme ruler, which embodies the essential element of monarchy, who is Simon, who serves as commander-in-chief of the armies, high priest of the religious cult, and political leader of Judea, recognized by outsiders as such. We have the Sanhedrin, the consultative legislative body, who is responsible for suggesting new laws and checking that all new laws proposed by the supreme ruler and all new major government policies proposed by the supreme ruler are in conformity with God's laws. And this large body of 120 men is made up of priests, scribes, secular nobles, and elders of the cities and tribes in the state. Now, the reason for that is to have some representation of the different significant groups. The scribes are necessary because they have to weigh. They're the experts on the oral and written law, so their opinion would be sought by the others as to whether a new law was valid or not. And priests, again, because of their importance in the functioning of the religious establishment. That's why these bodies, these groups are represented here. For practical efficiency in day-to-day administration, certain of these Sanhedrin members have to do double duty. They have to sit in the legislative body and serve in the cabinet, just like in Canada or in the UK, or I presume in Australia, that those who are ministers of the government also are members of the parliament. You see, it's the same kind of arrangement. We don't have the same system here. But those of you from those countries, I think, can relate to that more easily. We have, you might say, almost a... we have a head of state and head of who is the functioning head of government. We have a legislative body which is more consultative than having the sole power in legislation. And then we have this administrative cabinet. Now, what kind of people would Simon have selected to be in his administrative cabinet? Here are the types of people in the Sanhedrin: priests, scribes, secular nobles, elders. Which ones would be the most likely to be chosen for the job of supervising at a high level complicated administrative decisions and implementation of those decisions? Dan? Why? You are correct, but why?
Because they tend to be wealthy, many of them in business, so they would be very capable administrators and other companies that give them jobs. Also, I'm given to be.
Exactly. For the same reason that many top businessmen have been recruited into high level of government service as administrators. They have acquired the expertise in running their own affairs, you see, and therefore you want to tap that expertise on behalf of the government. Now, who else in this group would have had experience in administration? You may have to think back at earlier lectures to find out, you know, who these people might have been. Robert? Not really, because they are city and local elders. They're used to functioning at low level, you see. We're talking about those who have had major administrative responsibilities. They definitely had some, but not exactly the kind that he would find most necessary. You see, that's why the secular nobles are more qualified, because they have managed large estates, you see. Lots of money, lots of people, have to be properly used in various assignments, things like that. Where else can we find here? Johan? Okay, which ones? Because remember back when somewhere we talked about there being an essential separation of priests into two major categories? The majority were those that lived on their own land and came up to Jerusalem only when they had to serve in the temple. And then you had a small number of priests who were always in Jerusalem. I call them headquarters priests, who helped the high priest with his responsibilities directly, you see. So it's these upper echelon priests that are recruited, as well as the secular nobles, to be members of the Sanhedrin. The administrative cabinet, because they possess the practical administrative moxie to be able to function and be of assistance to the monarch. Okay, now this separation of the government in this fashion did not become significantly important in the rule of Simon, but in succeeding reigns, if I can use that term, since we don't have kings, so to speak, this becomes a major source of tension within the government, the separation into an administrative cabinet and the consultative legislative assembly, and that will be the topic we take up next time, because it's that political conflict that eventually is to lead to outright civil war in the nation of Judea. What I want to finish up with this morning is an overview of the external relations of the Hasmonean state under Simon and his immediate successors, because we need to see what happened to Judea in this period of time, this first period of the Hasmonean rule. This was just the governmental structure and setup, and how and why it emerged. Simon, of course, founded this particular dynasty, ruling from 142 to 134 BC. He was followed as ethnarch and high priest and commander-in-chief by his son, whose name was John Hyrcanus, or Jonathan Hyrcanus, who ruled from 134 to 104 BC. John Hyrcanus had two sons. The older's name was Judah Aristobulus, and the younger's name was Jonathan Alexander. And Judah Aristobulus was married to a very capable woman by the name of Salome Alexandra. But Judah Aristobulus only ruled for 1 year, dying prematurely, as you would imagine. And then his widow married the brother, Jonathan Alexander. And therefore, Jonathan Alexander succeeded his brother in 103 and ruled till 76 BC. Jonathan Alexander had two sons, who are usually called Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. So now we have sort of a family tree of the early Hasmonean period, and we can talk about what happened to Judea's fortunes under the rulership down through the time of Jonathan Alexander, as far as external affairs or foreign relations. First of all, Judea managed to stay on the good side of all the major powers, which is a wise thing for a little country. That's just practical wisdom. So that meant staying on the good side of Syria, Egypt, and Rome, because Rome was growing increasingly more powerful in the eastern Mediterranean. By way of reference, in 146 BC, before Simon even became the ruler, Rome had conquered Greece. By 133 BC, Rome had gained control of parts of modern-day Turkey, what was then called Asia Minor, and so was a major figure already in the Middle East and had to be reckoned with. The second thing that took place was a considerable expansion of Judean territory. Considerable expansion of Judean territory. I'm not going to require that you know which ruler acquired what, because I don't think that's particularly important. But I want you to realize that from the time of John Hyrcanus, Judah Aristobulus, and Jonathan Alexander, Judea greatly expanded its territorial extent to include, first of all, as you might gather it would, Idumea and Samaria. Why were those the most logical areas that Judea would expand into? Kirby? Nope. Good try. But at least you're thinking geographically. That helps. Mark? Yeah, Samaria was immediately north of Judea. Idumea was immediately south. So if you're going to expand, that's usually what happens. You know, you take over the most nearby territory rather than leapfrogging to somewhere else. Idumea was attractive, you might say, as an area of expansion, because Idumea actually extended into what had been ancient Judea. For instance, Hebron, a city with tremendous importance emotionally to the Jews, because that's where the cave of Machpelah is, where Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were buried. That was in Idumea, you see. So that was something that, for even emotional reasons, they would have wanted to take over. Samaria, of course, being located to the north and always having been a thorn in their side, was a logical choice to take over as well. Judah Aristobulus' main contribution was to conquer Galilee. Did you ever notice how Galilee is described early in the Gospels? I think it's Matthew's Gospel. They that dwell in darkness have seen a great light. What was Galilee called? Anybody remember? Galilee of the what? Galilee of the nations. Or to use the Hebrew term, Galilee of the Goyim. Goyim is not exactly a pejorative term, but it means of the pagan nations. Galilee was a pagan area. What Judah Aristobulus did was to conquer it, forcibly convert many of its inhabitants to Judaism, and set a large number of Jews from Judea in Galilee. Basically, by positive inducements and threats, get them to move up there and establish Jewish population centers in Galilee to Judaize the region. That helps perhaps to explain in part why the Jews in Judea tended to look at Galilee with more than a little suspicion and view people from Galilee as being, well, not quite as good as we are. Because after all, they're either, you know, a mixture of real ethnic Jews and those who were pagans who were forcibly converted, or they were just outright pagan in their ultimate origins, who are the descendants of forcibly converted people. And to really doubt how, quote, Jewish they really were. Because remember, the period in which Jesus lived was very hung up on matters of genealogy. Really hung up on it. And so this is where the area of Galilee becomes Jewish for the first time, and in a way that sort of makes it almost second class as far as the Jews of Judea are concerned. And this is something, of course, that Jesus would have to have contended with. Now, what Jonathan Alexander added was the coastal plain, which was mainly Hellenistic, the area of southern Syria, which is today called the Golan, the area that in the New Testament was called the Decapolis, because they were consisting of several Hellenistic cities, 10 in number, of course, and all the area of Transjordan down to the border of Moab. It did not include Moab, but everything down to the border of Moab, from south of the Sea of Galilee across the Jordan, was absorbed by Jonathan Alexander. So all the Transjordanian territories from southern Syria down to the middle of the Dead Sea, where the border of Moab began, Idumea, Samaria, Galilee, the coastal plain, that's all now Judea. What then were the practical consequences? One, Judea survived. Now, why do I say Judea survived? Why did this ensure the survival of Judea? Because if Judea had not expanded and their relations with their neighbors had remained peaceful, they probably would have been assimilated to Hellenization simply by contact with them. If the relations with their neighbors had been hostile, they would have been conquered by their neighbors. So by expanding, Judea survived. Number two, Judea, by this expansion, now possessed all of the trade routes. Consequently, her economy was greatly stimulated, and she became very prosperous. Thirdly, because Jewish policy at this period was to forcibly convert all the inhabitants, or as many as they could, of the areas they conquered, with the exception of the Decapolis and certain cities in the coastal plain were exempted, not all of it, but certain cities, and they refused to convert the Samaritans for reasons of long historic standing, they greatly added to the pool of people who were at least identifiably Jewish, and they became for the first time an active proselytizing religion. Before, people who voluntarily wanted to worship the God of Israel could do so, like Ruth or Rahab or the Naaman the Syrian. You know, they were not refused, but they didn't actively go out to win people to the God of Israel as worshippers of the God of Israel. Now, for the first time, Jews are going out and forcibly converting others and also trying to induce people by positive persuasion to become Jews, with the idea of safeguarding their existence in this particular area. Okay, we'll let you go.